In this episode, we speak with Raj Dadatta, the co-founder and CEO of Bloomreach, a leading software platform for digital commerce experiences that powers brands representing 25% of retail e-commerce in the US and the UK. He is also the best-selling author of The Digital Seeker, a playbook for digital teams to win big. Founded in 2009 by Raj Dadatta and Ashutosh Garg, Bloomreach was primarily focused on creating products centered around site search, which later evolved to include additional tools for merchandisers, such as product recommendations. They unify real-time customer and product data, so businesses understand what customers really want. Before launching Bloomreach, Raj was entrepreneur in residence at More Davido Ventures, served as Cisco's director of product marketing, and was on the founding team of telecom company Firstmark Communications. I'm your host, RJ Lumba. We hope you enjoy the show. If you like the episode, click to follow.
RJ Lumba is the executive chairman of Market Insight Media and the managing partner of GrowthCap. He is the host of Great Entrepreneurs, a podcast for driven entrepreneurs and business owners. Our podcast covers all topics related to the entrepreneurial journey, from ideation to execution to optimization and to reaping the rewards of a well-run business. In the minutes ahead, we'll share with you unique insights and tactics from some of today's most accomplished and inspiring entrepreneurs.
Raj, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It's a delight to be with you.
It's great to be with you, RJ.
Where I thought we could kick off is better understanding the Bloomreach product. You know, as I was reviewing on your website the demo video, I was really struck by how seamless you make the experience work for almost anyone who is seeking to sell online and be an e-commerce entrepreneur or e-commerce CEO or scaler or marketer. Tell us a little bit about why Bloomreach is so distinct in its kind of abilities to provide this platform.
Yeah. Thanks for the question, RJ. And yeah, I think the best way to think about Bloomreach is to mirror the way we all shop online. So if we think about us as consumers, you know, we go out into the web, we're typically exposed to a brand often through some form of marketing, either through an ad or through an email message or SMS message or a referral of a friend. And then we'll go onto websites, we'll browse, we'll check out the products if we're interested in buying a pair of shoes or jewelry or whatever it might be. Ultimately, we'll find the product that we're interested in. We'll search for something very specific and we'll end up buying and then hopefully building a relationship with that brand. So the next time we keep up with its products. And so what Bloomreach does is power that whole customer journey. It powers everything from the first marketing touch points across the ads and the email and the SMS, all the way into the website when you're considering what to buy as an individual and into the search experience where you're trying to identify something specific. And then once you bought it, it re-engages you as a consumer to then continue that relationship on an ongoing basis to engage and buy more. And so that's what the Bloomreach platform does. Our vision has always been about creating a personalized web, about creating magical experiences, about making it possible so that if you're shopping across all these touch points digitally, it feels as intimate as if you're walking into a store and the person really knows you and knows exactly what to recommend and delivers that high quality experience. So that's very much the platform that Bloomreach set out to build. It turns out to be a lot more complicated to pull that off than one would think, given all the evolution of digital channels and all the many permutations of products and services and content you could be shown at any given millisecond. But that's what we do.
You know, one of the incredible things I've noticed, and I've talked to others about this, is like sometimes when you type into your search field on your iPhone or you're speaking out loud about certain products, somehow that information seems to be popping up in different areas. I'm not sure if you have any insight into this. Like, is there a way for phones to detect, or just speaking out loud if you happen to have an Alexa device, to detect like what then to feed you content-wise?
There are ways of doing that. I mean, you could assume that any digital interaction you have has some kind of fingerprint associated with it. And that fingerprint can then be associated with you, which can then be associated with any interaction you might have downstream. And so there's sort of the cool side of that, which I would say it's fun to go on Spotify and feel like Spotify can know you well enough to recommend a good song. But it's kind of creepy if you happen to be buying something for your wife, and then you see a random ad months later that seems to suggest that they tracked you across the web. So there's a fine line between healthy personalization and sort of privacy being intruded upon. But you know, we very much focus on what we call first party experiences, which is not enabling the data to leave the brand you're interacting with and not using it to sell to third parties or anything of that sort.
Now, you have a very interesting background, and I'd like to take a step in a different direction here in that you started off in finance, and then I think venture capital, and then you also have had some more tech corporate experience. Tell us about that, your kind of evolution, and then leading up to your decision to become an entrepreneur.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I feel like I was very lucky. You know, I'd had a strong foundation. Technically, I was an engineer in college and the like. And then, you know, I got into Wall Street, and Wall Street was great because I really didn't know anything about business. And so it gave me a course in business in a very short period of time where I would understand how companies worked and got valued and got sold and got bought and all of those things in a short period of time. And it taught me two things. One, it taught me a lot about business, but it also taught me that I didn't want to be on Wall Street, that I really missed building stuff as I had done prior. So that's really what took me down the entrepreneurial road. So fortunately, by the age of kind of 22, 23, I was back on the entrepreneurial path, involved in starting my first company. And I would say since that time, I've stayed on that entrepreneurial path. I've had stints at large corporates like Cisco because of the evolution of the companies I was involved in. But for the most part, I've been involved in entrepreneurship, investing in a more early stage context since that time. But that initial sort of education in finance, I think it served me well.
You know, it's interesting. We've had others on this podcast who are former bankers that then became entrepreneurs. What is it that you like the most about being an entrepreneur versus working in finance or a corporation?
I think the thing that I love is that anything is possible. You know, you can wake up one day and say, I want to go here, and you can just go there. You can say, I was going in this direction, but it's no longer working. I want to go here, and you can do that too. You're sort of limited by your own creativity and your ability to execute on your own plans and no other boundaries. And I just love that about entrepreneurship. I think all great things are at some point imagined. And that's what entrepreneurship gives you the ability to do. Now, it's not fun to imagine things and then never make them happen. And that's the other part of entrepreneurship, is that it challenges you to come up with real practical plans to get people on board with your ideas and to, you know, build. And so, yeah, I figured out pretty quickly that I loved entrepreneurship at 23 years old. And I don't think I've really looked back since. I still have a lot of friends from those early days on Wall Street that have mostly gone into private equity or something of that type and away from banking. But I found that I just got a lot of joy out of building stuff versus identification of patterns and, you know, purely investing.
Now, you've brought in outside capital and you have some notable investors in Goldman and Sixth Street, NEA. Was that decision made because you simply needed to scale fast? And so you needed outside capital. And so that's the route you wanted to take. Is that how you thought about it? Could you have not taken capital, or could you have taken less capital?
Yeah, I don't think I could have not taken capital for this idea. It was just too big an idea. In the end, the idea of building a AI-driven platform for e-commerce that powered billions of interactions online is not the kind of business that I felt like you can gather a couple of people and bootstrap your way to go make happen. It needed outside capital. It was perfectly suited for the venture capital model first, and then later the growth equity model. And so I think it needed outside capital. I was fortunate to have terrific early stage investors. Bain Capital Ventures was my first investor in the business. And then we had Lightspeed a few years later, and then we had NEA. And these were stalwarts of Silicon Valley, and they understood entrepreneurship. They understood technology. They understood risk. And they knew how to work with founders. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciated that. Then as the company has evolved and gotten to some scale, you know, and now we have almost 1,000 people, then the Goldmans, the Sixth Streets, they were perfect for that scale as well. They understood what it meant to be investing in a growth stage business that had a real business and had some scaling potential, but was not yet a public company. They understood that stage. So I've always felt capital and the investors need to match where you are in your life cycle, you know, what the dynamics are personally between the individuals involved. And I think we've been fortunate to have great investors at every step.
What's the kind of vision, I guess, both near term and long term? Do you anticipate you know, raising even more capital, becoming more ambitious and kind of what your future targets are? Are you looking to focus more on profitability? What's the vision?
Yeah. So I think I've always sort of thought about it as, you know, you have a product vision, you have a financial kind of set of objectives, and then you have, you know, what you're trying to do with your team and your people. You know, the product vision has been unchanged since the early days of Bloomreach, which is let's go personalize e-commerce. Let's make that happen at scale. That's a dream we continue to chase 15 years in. So not much has changed there. On the financial side, I want to build a multi-billion dollar software company. And that is what we are on course to go do. I think our last rounds evidence that, and our traction financially evidence that. As the company has scaled, one of the great things about Bloomreach, I feel like, is we've never overreacted to the times that were too good and never overreacted to the times that haven't been so good. And so, you know, we've always been centered on, let's focus on growing the business with smart decisions. Let's not make imprudent investments that don't, you know, have extraordinary uncertain outcomes. So we're never really focused on profitability, but we're always focused on smart uses of capital that have good return on investment. And in so doing, naturally, as the company is now where it is at the scale that it's at now, compared to where it might have been 5 years ago, we're a lot closer to profitability than we were, you know, a couple of years ago. But it's not like we must become profitable tomorrow. It's more like, let's keep balancing on the rule of 40. Let's keep seeing increased leverage in our investments. And anytime we want to turn profitable, we can. But let's not lose sight of the market and the growth potential.
And along this journey of building the company, has there been an experience with one of your investors where they really surprised you to the positive, where you weren't expecting them to provide an insight or to help you in a certain way, where you said, wow, now I'm really seeing the power of having this particular capital provider?
A lot of my investors have added value in various ways. But actually, one of the best things about my investor group has been just how incredibly supportive they have been in the times that haven't been good. And in the course of this journey, there were moments where this company multiple times could have gone under and was facing existential threats. And I remember plenty of calls to my key investors saying, you know, look, this whole thing could go down. You could lose all your money. I just want to be really clear about that. It's not going well. And there were times when I've made calls to say, hey, look, we need some capital to stay afloat. And at every one of those steps, they basically said, look, Raj, if you're here, we're here with you. And they supported us, you know, through those moments. And if they had not done that, the good times may never have come. And they did come later. And I think we rewarded their commitment with great returns since then. But that was not assured. And I appreciate it.
What's been the hardest part about building the company to where it is today? If you look back on your journey, was there one point in time you're talking about existential threats, experiences? What's been the hardest part about building the company?
I think if I trace it to a moment, there was a moment for sure in around, you know, kind of late 2015, early 2016. My co-founder had left the company. The company was declining in revenue. We did not have any capital. We clearly did not have product market fit. We had built an initial business that was collapsing. The newer investments were not yet paying off. It was dire straits all around. And I remember standing in front of a room of team members sort of saying, look, I wouldn't fault anybody for walking out the door today, but I'm here and the culture is intact and the mission is intact. And we're going to figure out a way to build a multi-billion dollar company. And a lot of people did stick around through that period of time. And we did it in the years after. But that was definitely a pivotal moment and one that requires you to sort of check your spine and whether you're an entrepreneur for the right reasons or whether you're only an entrepreneur in the good times. And I'm proud of how we handled, you know, a lot of those moments. And there have been similar moments like that all through the journey. There's plenty of lessons in building a at scale software company that I can share. But if I trace back to one pivotal moment, that was probably it. It was kind of midway through this journey.
Most of the times when I ask entrepreneurs about what's the toughest part, it's, you know, it typically goes back to people, like just always ensuring you have the right people. How would you describe the culture of your organization?
At Bloomreach, we've been incredibly intentional about the culture. Before I even started the company, I wrote a document about our culture and those same five core values that I wrote about even before I came up with the idea are intact today. So there's a certain consistency to our investment in culture that I think is a hallmark of Bloomreach, where just the same way we work on revenues and products, every quarter we do a barometer, we understand where it's going right, where it's going wrong, we tweak it. So I don't really ever believe that culture is something you do and then you're done. It's much more the kind of thing that you establish a set of principles, you stay consistent to those principles, and then you constantly put in place operational improvements that yield more and more outcomes that take you in the direction you're trying to go. And we have also a people-oriented mission, which is that this be the single most impactful professional experience of someone's life. And so that's not an easy goal to hit. And so we're always asking ourselves, what could we be doing to achieve that? So I think it's been a real strength of Bloomreach. It's in all the Glassdoor reviews and everywhere else. If you think about what it's rooted in as a principle, I call it a commitment culture. And what that means is that we're committed to each other. We're committed to our shareholders. We're committed to the customer. We're committed to the mission. And that's why we do what we do. And I believe that commitment is the root of prideful companies that build great things.
Mm-hmm. How much of this culture is driven by how you think about your own life philosophically?
I think a lot. I mean, most people who know me would read the Bloomreach culture document and say, yep, that's Raj. Or at least that's Raj on his best day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it is rooted in me. But what is incredibly cool is to see 1,000 people who have made it their own in their own ways and who've contributed to the pot along the way and who are stewards and ambassadors for it in perhaps better ways than I ever was. So it may have started with me. And I think if you read the core principles, you'll see a lot of me in it. If you look around the company, it's much more scalable than me at this point. It's baked into the fabric.
A couple questions before we head into the final portion of the interview. One is, do you believe entrepreneurs are born or made?
I think entrepreneurial qualities, you know, I wouldn't say born, but exist through people's upbringings. So I think born is an overstatement. I don't think it's genetic, but I do think that your early life has a lot to do with whether you develop those entrepreneurial qualities. But then becoming an entrepreneur is not having entrepreneurial qualities. It's actually becoming an entrepreneur. And a lot of that is learned.
Mm-hmm. What's the best insight or advice you've ever been given about building a company? Or what's the best insight that you've come up with after having built the company to this stage?
If I answer the first question first, which I think those are two kind of questions, in terms of starting a business or becoming an entrepreneur, you become an entrepreneur because you have no choice but to be an entrepreneur. You don't become an entrepreneur because you have considered the pros and cons and decided to become an entrepreneur, because the cons way outweigh the pros. The probability of success is incredibly low. There's a lot of celebration of success, but the norm is failure. The life is hard. The odds are against you. It's not the most risk-adjusted, smart decision to make. I think the best advice I can give to someone who's thinking about starting a business is, if it's a debate, it may not be the right choice. If you do it because it's just you have to do it for one reason or another, lack of choice, passion, that's how you see yourself, ambition, whatever the reason is, you're either going to do it or you're not going to do it, kind of. Now, that's a different question than how do you scale a business to where we are today with 1,000 people. That's much more, I think, about cultural foundations, right product market fit, surrounding yourself with the right set of people, and then adapting to markets as they go, because rarely is the trend that you identified when you started the business the only trend you're going to have to figure out over the life of the business.
Mm-hmm. And so if you had one drop of wisdom, sort of that mic drop quote you would give to anyone trying to pursue their entrepreneurial, they're either on the way or they're contemplating it, what would you be? Just, you know, one insight.
My one insight would be trust yourself. Because in the end, your business will succeed or fail on the basis of your own judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So you may as well trust yourself. Whoever you are, whatever you are, is the destiny of your business. There isn't a lot of advice to go get. There's no Yoda out there that's going to give you the force. It's just you.
Right.
So trust yourself.
Excellent. Last part of the interview here. Two questions. One is, can you tell us about a person who has had a profound influence on you?
I mean, the people in my life that have had the most impact are, of course, my family members. And if I think about my two parents, they were iconoclasts of their own time. My father was a world-leading agricultural scientist that invented a lot of the varieties of rice that we eat around the world. My mother was an extremely accomplished dancer and actress. Neither of them came from backgrounds that represented that they would go achieve those things, but they were iconoclasts and they were ambitious and they were talented and they found a way. And they always sort of imbued in me this idea that it doesn't matter what you do, but you just go look for hard things, make no excuses, and go find a way. And I think for me, that manifested through entrepreneurship. For them, it manifested in the pursuits that they chose, but they've clearly had the biggest impact.
Awesome. Last question. Can you tell us about a charity, cause, or other endeavor that you're passionate about?
Sure. Yeah, I'm on the board of two organizations, both of which I have passion for. One is an organization called Represent Us, which is really in the business of transforming our democracy to make it more democratic here in America. And really with all the challenges to our sort of system of government, making sure that moderation remains in our politics, that the people are really represented through the elected officials, which incredibly is not the case. Very often what the elected officials represent a minority view of the people. If we just did what 70% of the population of America agreed on, we'd have a very different country. And that's what I'm trying to help make happen with Represent Us. And it's a terrific organization. I'm also involved a little bit with the U.S. Tennis Association. I have a passion and a history in tennis. And so trying to help them grow the sport broadly. And so those are two organizations that I'm involved
with. Excellent. Well, Raj, want to thank you for taking the time to chat with us. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Thanks, RJ.